Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine appears to be escalating, while U.S.-Russia relations have seemingly deteriorated. But first, what might the so-called Republican sweep mean for everything from the climate, the economy, foreign policy, to democracy in the U.S.? We've got two experts with us now. Peter Hansen is professor of political science at the University of Denver. He's the author of Too Weak to Govern, Majority Party Power and Appropriations in the United States Senate. Sean Theriault also joins us. He's a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, and The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. I'll start with the election itself and what we can derive from it, what it's telling us about the U.S. electorate. And Peter Hansen, I think we should start with you because of this piece you did about Colorado. I thought it was an interesting argument that it's actually become more liberal in some ways, even though they elected a conservative rather than the Democrat. How do you explain this?
I think there are a number of interesting lessons to learn by looking at the Colorado election this year. The two candidates were Senator Mark Udall, an incumbent Democrat, and Cory Gardner, who was a congressman who decided to give up his seat to challenge Udall. The first big thing to understand, and this really applies, I think, to every race in the country, is that in other years, Mark Udall might have been perfectly safe. I think if Udall had been up in 2 years' time, we might be having a very different conversation right now. But this election was structured by two major factors, and I think these are true across the country. The first is that this is a midterm election in which turnout overall is lower than what we would see in a presidential year, and also tended to favor Republicans. And that's simply because Democrats, because they tend to be younger and lower income, are less likely to turn out to vote during a midterm election. So that was the first major factor that gave Republicans an advantage in this election. The second is the unpopularity of Barack Obama right now. The president can act as a drag on the fortunes of senators and members of Congress who are for election, who are of the president's party, and that was happening in this election. So those two features really put Mark Udall in striking distance, Cory Gardner, and made it a very competitive race. Now, with those two things understood, there's been a lot of discussion about the particular campaign tactics that unfolded in this race. The thing that's particularly interesting is that it's centered on women's reproductive rights. And what was really different in this election from previous cycles in 2012 or 2010 is the dramatic change we saw on the Republican side. In previous years, we've seen Republicans making some really boneheaded statements when it comes to reproductive rights. This year, Cory Gardner started out doing everything he could to insulate himself from attacks that he was hostile to women's rights. So Gardner, in the past, had supported what's known in Colorado as the Personhood Amendment. That's an amendment that would say that life begins at conception, and as a result, it would criminalize abortion and make certain kinds of birth control illegal. Gardner began this race by repudiating that stance, then actually went on the offensive by offering a plan to make birth control more widely available for women. Democrats, on the other hand, stuck with their tried-and-true strategy of attacking Gardner on what was now his past record on women's reproductive rights and didn't seem to gain a lot of traction doing that. The Udall campaign has been criticized in recent days for not adjusting its tactics after Gardner changed his position. I think whether or not a different strategy from the Udall side would have made a difference in this race is debatable, given the other factors that were unfolding. But in any case, Udall did end up losing this race. The interesting thing I noted, though, and this is the point I was trying to make in the piece you referred to, is that at least from the standpoint of social issues, this race was debated entirely in Democratic territory. We did not see Republicans standing up for an anti-abortion platform. They could easily have talked about the fact that Colorado has legalized civil unions, and in fact, gay marriage is now possible in the state. Gardner was silent on that. We heard nothing about marijuana legalization from the Republican side. They really completely stood down on the kind of cultural issues they used to talk about so much in these elections. Ironically, one of the things that handicapped Mark Udall in this race is that Democrats seem to have won the battle for public opinion on social issues to the extent that Republicans didn't even contest it. So I suppose there's some comfort in that fact for Democrats, in that those policy gains seem to be pretty secure now, although I still think they prefer to have the Senate seat as well.
Sean Theriault, what are your observations?
Peter gave a really excellent answer for what happened in Colorado. But I would even take it a step further and say that Cory Gardner, in addition to running a pretty good campaign, was a great candidate. And that we saw the Republicans do in 2014 in a way they really hadn't in 2010 or 2012, in that just about in every single one of these competitive House and Senate races, the Republicans nominated the best possible candidate they could have for the general election. I dare say that if Ken Buck were running against Mark Udall this election, it would have been much closer, and I think that Udall may have even been able to pull that seat out. But Cory Gardner couldn't be typecast in the same way that Ken Buck and some of those other Tea Party candidates from elections past could have been typecast.
What about the role in some states of restrictive voter laws? Did that come into play at all, Sean Theriault?
What we see is that turnout was really weird throughout the nation. So in some states it was really low, like Virginia, and in other states like Colorado, it seemed like for the Democrats it was really low, but for the Republicans it seemed to be all right. In Kansas, the turnout was great for Republicans. In fact, I think because those races were so close. I still think we're trying to parse out exactly in what states it went down and what states it went up and trying to map that on to those states that adopted some of those more restrictive measures. For a long time, the talking points on the restricting access to the ballot was that for every step that the Republicans took in trying to restrict the ballot access, the Democrats took in mobilizing those people who otherwise might not turn out. And there's no greater motivation for people to turn out than to suggest that their ballot is under some type of threat. But then we saw a study come out about 6 months ago from the GAO that put some of those ideas of the conventional wisdom a little bit. They challenged them with more data that suggested that, in fact, some of these restrictive measures do seem to have had the intended effect of restricting access to the ballot. But I think the script on that exact question for 2014 is still being written.
So now we've got Republicans solidly in the majority of both houses and the Democrat, of course, President Obama, in the White House. How do we expect the policies to change? Will it be drastic? Will it be apparent in some areas and not so much in others? Can we predict this, Sean Theriault?
It depends a little bit on the way the Republican Party acts. The conversation that I want to hear is the one between my own home state senators here in Texas. I want to hear what Ted Cruz and John Cornyn are talking about in terms of strategy. Because if John Cornyn can get Ted Cruz to go along with the platform, then I think that we could see the Republicans putting forward some real policy solutions, some alternatives. And I think that the Obama White House would be hard-pressed to veto all of them coming out of the House and the Senate. But I could see them kind of negotiating and trying to figure out where we should go in the next 2 years. But if Ted Cruz continues to act in the future as he has in the past, then I think that he has enough votes that it would make getting any type of policy through the Senate even more difficult than it's been in the past few years. But the one thing I feel pretty certain about is that we're not going to see any drastic policy changes. I think any policy changes we do see are largely going to be along the margins, and they're not going to have much of an ideological component. It's not going to be swinging policy to the left or swinging policy to the right. But I think where we will see bills getting passed and then signed by the president is in making programs run more efficiently or in making a program work better than it has in the past. But I don't think that we're going to see much of an ideological because, of course, the Republicans will want to move right. They will be vetoed by the president. The president, of course, wants to move policy more to the left. Isn't going to pass either the House or the Senate.
Peter Hansen, do you agree?
Yeah, I would make a few additional points, too, to what Sean has said. You know, there is sometimes an assumption that divided government means that Congress will get nothing done. Of course, that's not true. If you think back to the Clinton administration after Republicans took the Congress, in the 1994 elections, there were certainly some major showdowns between the two sides. And, of course, that's when there was a budget showdown that led to a shutdown of the federal government. But Clinton also worked with the Republicans to pass welfare reform. And that was an extraordinarily consequential change in policy. So really the question I think Republicans need to answer right now is, you know, are they going to spend the next 2 years in an acrimonious effort against the White House to try and set the stage for winning the presidency in 2016, or do they see some areas where they can actually reach some compromises with the president? And, you know, there are areas where that's desperately needed. We really need Congress to act on immigration reform, for example. And I think Republicans understand that they need to act on immigration reform. So that might be an area where we could see some movement.
The one thing that I would caution, and I've heard lots of people do this, not only Peter, people frequently talk about Clinton and working with Congress, but we're talking about a very different Republican Party then, and we're talking about a very different president then. I think Bill Clinton loved politics. He had been working Republicans from the day that he was inaugurated. He was always having congressional leaders down to the White House, and there's nothing the guy liked more than kind of gnawing over policy ideas and potential solutions to policy problems. But we've never seen Obama engage Congress in quite that extent. And then I think that Clinton had a legitimate partner over in the Republican Party willing to work with him. The Republicans are going to have to prove that they would be willing to sit down at the same table and talk about these issues with Obama. I can't see it happening as easily as these people that want us to think back to the late 1990s.
Can't see it happening for a few reasons. Among them, they've spent the last 6 years building this sort of hate frame around President Obama. Well, granted, it would make sense for him to try to compromise with them in some ways. It has not looked very amicable between them and not necessarily coming from him.
Right. The one thing I would add, that the more popular Obama becomes, the easier it is for Hillary Clinton or someone like Hillary Clinton to eventually claim the White House in the elections of 2016. The more unpopular he looks, then the easier it is for the Republicans to win the White House in 2016. Mitch McConnell has one of the keenest minds on Capitol Hill, and I dare say that he's well aware of those types of trends and where they could lead.
If I could jump in here, too, I think Sean's exactly right that the ideological differences between the White House and the Republicans are much deeper than they would have been in the 1990s. I would point out a couple of things, though. You know, first of all, there is a track record of President Obama reaching deals with Mitch McConnell. The major budgetary deals we have reached in the last few years, and obviously there's a tremendous amount of work to do, but what they have passed has resulted from the White House reaching an agreement with McConnell. Ironically, it has been John Boehner over in the House who has at times attempted to reach deals with the White House but been unable to sell them to his own caucus. What's interesting now after this election is that Boehner expanded his majority, and I think one of the hopes on the Republican side was that the increased numbers now in their conference in the House would make it a little easier for Boehner to put together winning coalitions within his own party. Remember, the budgetary deals agreed to between McConnell and the White House only passed the House of Representatives because John Boehner brought them to the floor and they passed with majority Democratic support and then a minority of Republicans. So Boehner might have a little bit of an easier time now with his own caucus. I'm not as pessimistic about the willingness of Republicans to reach a deal as I think Sean is. I think Mitch McConnell's shown that in the past. I think, you know, on the Republican side, it's going to be a matter of strategy. Do they want to reach those deals with the president, or do they see a greater advantage in just having 2 years of gridlock and conflict that might, in their minds, position them better for 2016?
Some of the policy areas that I'm hearing rumblings about that the Republicans do want to pursue, one pertains to the Keystone Pipeline. The second is tax reform. And then the third is to insert themselves more into what's traditionally been the domain of the president, and that is foreign policy. Do you see these as the primary areas in addition to immigration, or do you not think that these are some that will come to pass? Sean Theriault?
I think that immigration is the hardest one of those four that you listed, where I just can't see things happening, because I think the Republican conference in the House is still really conservative, and any bill that comes out of the House that John Boehner would put on the House floor, there's no chance that President Obama is going to sign it. But some of those other issues are more interesting. You know, I think the president seriously hasn't made up his mind yet on the Keystone Pipeline. So I think that there could be some type of mini bargain that happens between the White House and Congress on that issue. Maybe it's tied to some environmental regulation, maybe it's tied to infrastructure, maybe it's tied to alternative energy investments. But I think there could be room for agreement there. In tax policy, I think that that area is also a little bit more ripe for compromise than some of the other things that we're talking about. Because at the end of the day, there are a lot of debate there centers around numbers. And so it's pretty easy for the president to come up or down and to meet halfway to the folks in Congress. And so there's some leverage there where I just don't see it with immigration, where where we could have enhanced border patrols, but where the Republicans would never agree to anything involving pathway to citizenship. And I can't imagine the president would ever sign a bill unless if there was some type of guaranteed a pathway to citizenship. So some of these number debates that we get with economic or tax policy, I could see some type of compromise. But I think even then we're dealing with numbers at the margins. We're not dealing with anything as big as welfare reform or anything like that.
Peter Hansen, what do you see?
Of course, I'm very interested in what's going to be happening in the Senate. And Mitch McConnell has given some conflicting signals. On the one hand, he said he wants to use the budget to more aggressively challenge the president. Of course, that kind of language does worry me. And it worries me because Republicans have tried this in the past. It inevitably leads to serious conflict that twice in the last 20 years has led to government shutdowns. I would hope that Republicans would be a little smarter than going down that road again. I think, in fact, actually the last time I was on the show with Sean was when we were talking about previous government shutdown. And of course, that ended very badly for Republicans. The second thing I'm interested in seeing on the Senate side is whether or not Mitch McConnell is going to follow through on his pledge to open up debate on the Senate floor. He has expressed a tremendous amount of frustration with some of the tactics that Majority Leader Harry Reid has used to limit amending and limit debate on the Senate floor. He's promised he's going to open things back up, allow freer amending on the Senate floor. But I think he's going to very quickly find that that's going to be a problematic strategy for him. If he does that, that will allow Democrats in the Senate to call up their own policies, to force votes on issues Republicans may not want to vote on. And I think if, in fact, he goes down this road and opens up debate, it could open up some unexpected policy debates and actually give Democrats an opening to put their own issues on the agenda.
The one thing that I would add is not only is he going to feel pressure from Democrats in voting on some of these amendments, but I think he's also going to be facing some pressure from the Ted Cruz and Mike Lees of the world, who are going to try and put up amendments to see who a true conservative is and to see who a squishy conservative is. So I think that he's going to be getting it from both sides. And additionally, there's an additional level of complexity for Mitch McConnell's job, and that's that he's going to have some folks who are going to be running for president from the Senate, and so they're going to want to prove their conservative bona fides as we go through the primary process. And at the same time, he's going to have a handful of Republican senators who have to run in pretty blue states in 2016 who are going to want to show that they can compromise and solve some problems so that they could survive their elections in 2016. So he's going to be feeling all sorts of pressure from all sorts of different angles.
The last thing I really wanted to get a read on is kind of where we started with what are we learning about the electorate itself. And it sounds like we have a more socially liberal country in some ways. But it seems to me also that we're seeing a more economically conservative country. Would you say that's true, Peter Hansen?
I'll make a couple of points here. First, it is true if you look at polling data that on a wide variety of social issues, the country is moving leftward. And by that, I mean, if you look at public opinion on same-sex relationships or marijuana legalization, the two issues that are in the news a lot right now, the country is clearly liberalized on those. On other issues like abortion, I wouldn't say that's taken place. I think those opinions have been pretty set in place for a long time. The bigger point I want to make about, you know, how to interpret this election is that I'm very, very cautious about trying to, you know, these sweeping statements we see coming out of the media that the voters have just sent a signal to Washington or something like that. It's really important to remember that the electorate that just showed up in 2014 is very different than the one that showed up in 2012. First of all, it was much smaller. This was a different group of voters that showed up in 2014 than 2012. There were fewer of them. They were older. They were more conservative. So it's the nature of the electorate that helps to explain the results we saw. If you look ahead to 2016, the electorate is going to be quite different once again. It's going to be much larger. It will include many more minorities. It will include younger people. So I am less inclined to say that this election tells us the country has moved a particular direction than I am to say a different group of voters showed up with different values. And that's really what we should focus on, as opposed to the notion that there's been dramatic change in the way voters think.
Sean Theriault.
Peter, I think, does a great job of encapsulating the electorate that we had in 2014 and how that's going to change in 2016. The one thing that I would add is going back to the Tea Party election of 2010, I would remind everyone that that was very much about economic issues, too. It was about the huge stimulus package that Obama had passed and the huge deficits that we were running. But yet, when the Republicans took over then in 2011 and 2012, there were a whole lot of policies that they weren't talking about during the election that reared both in Congress and around state legislatures. So my hope for our country is that this time the Republicans, as they won record number of seats in state legislature and a record number of chambers in state legislatures and also in seats in the House, is that they don't forget that they were running on economic issues and they weren't talking a whole lot about further restrictions to the ballot, or they certainly during this election weren't talking about restrictions to a woman's right to choose, and they certainly weren't talking about constitutional amendments for same-sex marriage. And so I think it would be a testament to the Republican leadership if they can keep those issues off the legislative floors, but rather focus on these more economic issues and these job bills and the things that they were talking about during the election. But only time will tell.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Peter Hansen, professor of political science at the University of Denver and author of Too Weak to Govern, Majority Party Power and Appropriations in the U.S. Senate. Sean Theriault, professor in the Department of Government at University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention and Voter Retribution and the Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
My pleasure.
When we come back, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine appears to be escalating, while U.S.-Russia relations have seemingly deteriorated. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Russia-Ukraine crisis has escalated once again with reports from the Ukrainian government of Russian tanks crossing the border into eastern Ukraine. Despite a peace agreement made in early September, fighting has continued, with hundreds killed since then, according to the BBC. Tensions have heightened between Russia, the U.S., and its allies. Russia has boycotted President Obama's 2016 International Nuclear Security Summit. It's flown bombers over the European skies and infiltrated the White House computers. What is fueling these escalations and what can be done to allay the tension? With us are four experts. Robert English is a professor of international relations and the director of the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Russia and the Idea of the West, Gorbachev, Intellectuals and the End of the Cold War, The Politics of Russian National Identity, and The Other Side, How Soviets and Americans Perceive Each Other. John Mearsheimer is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He's the author of The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. Molly O'Neill joins us. She is a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University and a former diplomat in the region. Her forthcoming book is called Democracy, Civic Culture, and Small Business in Russia's Regions. Anthony Antoine also joins us. He is the executive director of the Institute for European Studies at the University of Brussels. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you all here with us. John Mearsheimer, we're beginning with you. You've argued that the West needs to take some responsibility for this current evolving crisis with Russia and the West. Why do you say this?
Well, the present crisis is largely about Ukraine. And my argument is that genesis of the Ukrainian crisis is that the West has been trying to peel Ukraine away from Russia's orbit and make it a Western bulwark. And it's done that with three particular strategies. One, and most importantly, is NATO expansion. Two is EU expansion. And three is democracy promotion in Ukraine, which is basically a way of putting in power leaders who are pro-Western. And again, this is all designed to create a state on Russia's border that is allied in a deep-seated way with the West. The Russians have made it clear since the mid-1990s, and certainly since 2008, that this was unacceptable and that it was eventually going to lead to a crisis. They have made it perfectly clear to the West on numerous occasions that the idea of NATO and the West more generally marching up to their doorstep was viewed as threatening by them, and it was not going to be tolerated. They were thinking much the way we think with our Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere. We've basically told all distant great powers that they're not allowed in our neighborhood, that we view distant great powers bringing military forces into the Western Hemisphere as a threat to our security. The Russians are basically saying the same thing. There's no way you're going to bring a military alliance up to our doorstep in Ukraine and not precipitate a crisis. And their promise came true this February. And we, of course, are doubling down on our strategy and making a bad situation worse.
You've also suggested in your op-ed piece that Ukraine in particular has a real historic significance to Russia and its fear of history repeating itself. What is that history?
Well, the fact is that Ukraine is a big swath of territory that sits on Russia's western border. And, for example, on June 22, 1941, when the Soviet Union was invaded by Nazi Germany in Operation Barbarossa, a huge chunk of the German forces went through Ukraine. There's no way that the Russians are going to tolerate other great powers sitting on their borders. And this is why, by the way, at the end of the Cold War, the Russians, it was the Soviets at the time, later the Russians, exacted a promise from us that we would not expand NATO eastward. And we gave them that promise at the end of the Cold War. It was done verbally. It was not done in writing. But the historical record is clear here that we gave them that promise. And this is because the Russians simply would not countenance the idea of NATO marching up to their doorstep in countries like Ukraine and countries like Georgia.
Before we get the other scholars to come in and respond to this, what do you suspect is the U.S.'s motivation to expand NATO in this way?
Well, many people think that what the United States was doing and what the West more generally was doing was trying to contain a Russian threat. There are many people who think that we understood from the mid-1990s forward that Russia was a threat, and this was certainly true after Putin took over. And what we were trying to do was expand NATO eastward for the purposes of containing him. I believe there's hardly any evidence to support that view. And instead, what NATO was doing was operating not according to basic realpolitik principles, but the liberal idealism that has infected U.S. foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. We believed that we had created this security community in Western Europe, and what we wanted to do was extend that security community up to the Russian border, and then maybe even include the Russians in NATO. If you talk to Michael McFaul, who was the Obama administration's ambassador in Moscow in recent years, he will tell you that he talked to Putin on numerous occasions, and Putin's lieutenants as well, and told them that NATO expansion was not a threat to Moscow, that in no way did NATO expansion constitute a military threat the way the Russian leaders saw it. McFaul was being honest. He didn't think it was a threat. Most of the American and the Western elites did not think that marching NATO and the EU up to Russia's doorstep was in any way threatening to the Russians. The Russians, of course, rejected this logic and said it is threatening to us. But the Americans and the West more generally, thinking they knew what was better for Putin than what Putin himself thought, just neglected to pay attention to what Putin said. And the end result is that we got a crisis in February of this year, and the West was shocked that this happened. They were shocked because they didn't think Putin was a threat. They didn't think Russia was a threat to conquer Crimea or eastern Ukraine. They thought that Russia would roll over and accept this expansion, even though the Russians had told them on countless occasions that was not going to happen.
Rob English, would you agree?
Yes, I would in large measure agree. And let me try to add one thing to this, because rather than talking about Russia or Ukraine for the moment, I'm fascinated by, you know, Professor Mearsheimer has raised the Obama administration, some officials, what they thought they were doing. I'll put it simply, for whatever reason, the team in the State Department and Executive Office advising the president not only on post-Soviet Russian issues, but many other issues, and also not just with holdovers from the Bush administration, but some of the same ideology, as strange as that sounds, all kind of shared this sort of, I won't call it messianic, but this naive belief in affecting rapid transitions to democracy, that we can help with regime change here or support one side in a conflict there, you know, engineer elections, one way or the other, breakthrough from these horrible dictatorships or autocracies that are so nasty and help put Democrats in power, and then everything will be great. Obviously, we all know now that they've made a lot of mistakes in that. It is kind of odd that with the mistakes of Iraq in a different part of the world, but making the same mistake in judgments, the Obama people would repeat some of those mistakes. What I want to say instead, or my emphasis is, this almost exclusive focus on the domestic politics and democratization and regime change and supporting liberalization as we saw it within different countries pushed aside essential understanding of geopolitics and the international side, the balance of power. And Professor Mearsheimer puts it very simply but very convincingly. And when you step back and say, yeah, look at the last 3, 4, or 5 years, 90% of what our congressional testimony by top officials, the focus in research of the academics who come in and advise the president or the State Department, and much, much more. It's overwhelmingly, you know, methodologically, ideologically, in every respect, focused on domestic change, domestic democratization, naive at that, to the exclusion of country security interests and the geopolitical or the international side.
Molly O'Neill.
I agree to a considerable extent that a lot of the responsibility for the crisis was, as Professor Mearsheim said. I think, though, it's important now just to assess where we go from here. And in particular, I think that the emphasis that the U.S. placed upon democratization in the post-Cold War period was, I suppose, vindicated to some extent by the success of the countries of Central Europe and so on, which we're remembering today in the 25th anniversary of the Berlin Wall falling and so on. And I think that we, having been a diplomat, I'm well aware that we, you know, lived in a world, we convinced ourselves in these last 25 years that great power rivalry was kind of, you know, not an issue. I mean, in other words, we were in a different kind of a world, and perhaps we thought that was the permanent state of affairs. And I think we've now had a rude awakening that we haven't ended history and so on, and now we have a much more adversarial relationship, whoever's fault it is, with Russia now possibly for the foreseeable future. And what I think that we need to do now is to remember at least some of the lessons of the calmer parts of the Cold War and to try to avoid miscalculation and misunderstandings that could result in the catastrophic consequences. And so what I'd like to suggest is, first of all, emphasis upon trying to advance some process of reconciliation in Ukraine. That's for starters. I don't know, you know, how much success we're likely to have with that. But I would like to say that some aspects of this would involve, in my mind at least, efforts to reinforce the role of the OSCE further on the ground in Ukraine so that problems of misinformation and misreporting and rumor, which are very explosive in that context, could be diminished. We saw that today with the report of a tank column moving into Ukraine, which I gather hasn't been confirmed. I think it would be useful for the U.S. to try to restore momentum to the Minsk process, which we've stood rather remotely from up until now. I don't know whether deliberately or as a sort of in a fit of inattention, but the U.S. has not been very engaged in the diplomatic efforts as far as I can tell. There have been at least a few hopeful developments, such as the fact that Russia formally recognized the national elections, parliamentary elections in Ukraine, and Ukraine together with EU mediation agreed on the natural gas supply for the coming winter and the price of that and so on, and that Russia so far has not recognized in a formal sense the elections that were held in the separatist-held territories. Also, I'd like to mention a lot of the press reporting suggests that Poroshenko lost the election narrowly to his rival Yatsenyuk from the People's Front. This is true insofar as the list voting was concerned, but in the single mandate races, Portugal's Bloca did considerably better than Yat Finneyuk people, and in particular, have performed well in the south and the east, relatively well. I think this points to a possibility that Poroshenko, with a proper support and with, you know, Russian acquiescence, could possibly help to heal the divide in Ukraine. And I do think the problem in Ukraine is, to a greater extent than is normally acknowledged, a problem in Ukraine and not a problem that Russia has created or that the U.S. has created, for that matter. And then finally, on the issue of U.S.-Russia relations, I think that it's very unfortunate, in my opinion, that one of the first steps that was taken was for the NATO-Russia Council to suspend its work. It seems to me that one of the major attributes of something like that would be crisis management, and I think that that's sorely missing in terms of avoiding, as I say, misinterpretation and a spiraling tit-for-tat measures where defensive steps by one side are understood as offensive by the other side. This is a pattern that we're very familiar with from the Cold War, and we know better than to repeat it. We should know better. I do agree that the U.S. foreign policy has sorely lacked a strategic focus, and perhaps we've had a vacation, as I've said, from reality for a long time, and I do think that we need to find those talents that we once had to manage difficult relationship and to remember that cooperation with Russia is incredibly important still on a major list of key issues for the United States, including the Iran nuclear portfolio, the Iraq and ISIS problem, the resupply and withdrawal from Afghanistan, and an eventual resolution of Syrian civil war. So for all those reasons, I think that we need a new burst of diplomatic revision of our diplomatic approach in the United States to take account of these new realities.
Spoken like a true diplomat. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the heightened tensions between Russia, Ukraine, and Russia and the West. I wonder if we could bring in Anthony Antoine to get a European perspective on this as well, particularly with this aspect of European expansion. Also, we've seen the submarine issue and the bomber planes issue coming in close into Europe. I mean, what is the European politic in this?
The European politic in this is a bit difficult to tell because, as you all must know, there's different European politics depending on which country you're at. And despite all the efforts of getting a one stand, it's still not there. Now, if I just may come back a little bit to Professor Mearsheimer's explanation earlier on, one element I miss in that is the Ukrainian point of view, in fact, because we seem to all forget that Ukraine is a very divided country with aspirations to the West and to the East. And that, of course, has been one of the main problems in the past, that it's been at the stalemates. It never could decide where to go. NATO wasn't very keen on embracing Ukraine, at least not until a couple of years ago, especially because, well, they know the significance of Ukraine to Russia, with links going back to the 9th century and so forth. So there's not been that big stand of getting Ukraine into a Western sphere from the West, I take. Same thing with Europe. The EU, as such, has been very cautious in dealing with Ukraine. And of course, now with the latest events, has been pushed a bit more towards Ukraine. But I don't think it has the means or even the willingness to really go for it. You can see that it's already the willingness of donating money or loans and so forth. It all goes very, very difficult. And that, I think, is one of the problems. I do agree with Professor Mearsheimer when he says the problems are mainly from the West. Yes, they have been, but they've also been aggravated by the fact that the West hasn't been doing anything to really embrace Ukraine within the West over the past years. I'm not saying that that would be a good idea. I'm just saying that for Ukraine itself, it has been very difficult in choosing anything because going too far to the east really aggravates the situation in Western Ukraine. Going too far to the west aggravates the situation in Eastern Ukraine, and therefore it's a standstill. And nobody wants to put in extra money, let alone military, to actually solve that problem.
And it sounds from some of the work that Robert English has done that within Ukraine, the politics are polarized. Robert English, I'm going to go back to you in a minute on that, but want to let John Mearsheimer respond to this concern.
I think that Anthony's point that my story, as I told it, left out the Ukrainians is correct. And he's obviously right that Ukraine is a badly divided country. But I'd make two additional points. One is that I believe the principal victims in this story are the Ukrainians, because I believe as a result of our policies and the present crisis, what's happening is that Putin has, number one, taken away the Crimea, and number two, he is in the process of wrecking Ukraine as a functioning society for the purposes of making sure that it never becomes part of the West. I mean, what's happening to Ukraine today is absolutely horrible, but it's happening in large part because Putin wants to make sure that it's not a viable country that can become a Western bulwark. So what we have in effect done over time, and I think this is consistent with what Anthony said, is we have led the Ukrainians down the primrose path. We have encouraged them to become part of the West. We have told them that that would be possible, that they could eventually join NATO, that they could become a democratic state and pro-Western, when in fact we have been unwilling to defend them when they ran into trouble. And we have stood by and watched the Russians intervene in eastern Ukraine and done nothing. So we have led them down the primrose path. And by the way, we did the same thing to the Georgians in 2008. After the famous April 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest, we led the Georgian leadership to think that it could become part of the West. It could join NATO. So the Georgians became quite uppity. They became quite pro-Western in their rhetoric and their behavior. This spooked the Russians, and no surprise, in August 2008, you had a war between Russia and Georgia, and it was largely over this NATO expansion issue. And what did the United States and the West more generally do after encouraging the Georgian leadership to go down this road? Nothing. They stood by and allowed the Russians to, in effect, crush the Georgians. So our behavior here has been remarkably foolish.
There are two things here on the table. There's the internal politics within Ukraine, and then there is this Western behavior with the former Soviet countries. Robert English, I know that the polarization within Ukraine is something that you have written about. How can we understand this and how it's contributing to the crisis we're getting into?
Well, of course, now, since the elections and the standoff and then the uprising that drove out Yanukovych and collapse of the agreement that had been brokered and then the more serious violence in eastern Ukraine, the people who were, you know, burned alive in a building in Odessa, atrocities on both sides. By the way, to the extent that major human rights organizations like Freedom House, Amnesty International are essentially saying, they have been for months, a plague on both your houses. They see the brutal behavior by extreme nationalists on both sides. But I would like to go back. I guess what I'm saying there, excuse me, is once the 3,000-4,000 people have died and so much vicious behavior has been perpetrated, of course the divisions are so deep and it's so much harder to think of reassembling this country and reconciling. But I want to, again, maybe I'm tilting at windmills or pushing against an open door, when I want to correct kind of a misapprehension or just constant omission in the Western, not just mass media coverage, but, you know, in our commentariat, in the kind of foreign policy and the op-eds that are supposedly written by experts. You might have the impression reading these that all this is manufactured, that whether Putin is simply a Hitler reborn or is responding, as Professor Mearsheimer persuasively argues, to what it sees as Western threats to its security interests, whatever it might be, you could nevertheless have the impression that Putin goes in like some kind of Milosevic and stirs up separatism and arms people and creates these from scratch. I talk to my students, and they're shocked to know that Crimea didn't hold its first referendum just back in March or April on the eve of annexation by Russia. The Crimeans have been chronically unhappy and protesting their treatment at the hands of the central Ukrainian government ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there was a referendum back in 91, there was another in the mid-90s, I'm not sure it was 95 or 96. This problem has been simmering, these fights over language and cultural rights between centralization versus federalization. Putin did not create this. So yes, Maria, you're right to focus us back to the simmering and long-standing divisions. They are the fertile soil which these other issues come into play on. Similarly, I tell students, they suddenly hear about frozen conflicts elsewhere, for example, in eastern Moldova, the so-called Transnistria region, as if Putin created this. That conflict goes back not only to Boris Yeltsin, but to Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, literally, I was in Chisinau, Dubosari, Benderi, all the capitals on both sides of that Moldovan conflict. Remember, it was Revolution Day, November of 1990, right? I mean, Mikhail Gorbachev would be in power for another year, and already that war had broken out, and there were barricades along the Dniester River between the two sides. Again, Putin didn't create it. It's been going on for two decades. And let's go back to Georgia, the same thing. The Ossetians, secession, attempted secession, the Abkhaz fight with the central Georgian government, again, both go back to the late 80s. No doubt subsequent Russian presidents have sided with one over the other, and they have, where it suited them, drawn the secessionist minorities to their side, offered them support or arms where it suited them. It's part of a larger geopolitical battle to keep out American bases or maybe vis-a-vis Turkey or Iran, as the case may be in Central Asia. The first thing I want to do is correct Americans and Westerners' broad misapprehension that all things were rosy and democratic until this evil Putin came along. Well, you know what? Gorbachev and even more, the Democrat free marketeer we love to praise and remember, Boris Yeltsin, were every bit as violently opposed, protested every bit as loudly as Putin has. They just lacked the power to do anything about it.
What about the leadership? First, there's American leadership, of course. It seemed to me that in the early parts of the Obama administration, there had been some pretty serious agreements, some handshakes when Medvedev was sitting in the seat where Putin is now. A lot of that has sort of come to pass. Does leadership matter there? Does it matter in the U.S.? Anthony Antoine?
I think that leadership does matter. Well, of course, there's the time that helps leadership, the circumstances, but there's also the leadership itself. And I think the fact that we don't have a strong leadership in Europe is one of the elements why we have the crisis of today. The fact that you do have a strong leadership in Russia is equally a fact for that. So, yes, to be brief, leadership does matter. And if you look at Putin, his whole stance was to create stability and to have Russia regain its pride that it used to have and that it used to also have under the Soviet Union. Well, he is, of course, not doing this alone, but he came at a certain time where this was needed and where he got a very broad popular support for that. And now he has a power base that is far bigger than when he once started and allows him to do the things that he does today. If he's now annexing de facto Crimea, if he's now going into Ukraine, well, he has this power base, and at the same time, Europe doesn't and is not even, I won't say interested, of course they're interested, but they're not in power to do anything against that.
Molly O'Neill, let's bring you back in. There's been quite a bit of talk about anti-Russian sentiment emerging from a lot of countries. Now, you've lived throughout that region. How would you say that you experience that as part of this milieu?
I very much deplore the tendency now in the American media to reduce the entire problem, the Ukraine crisis, to the villainy and the perfidy of this evil genius, Putin, and so on. I'm afraid that this is producing a perverse outcome, in terms of, as Professor Mearsheimer said, it's quite evident that the U.S. is not prepared to forcefully, react, use military force against Russia to insist upon Ukraine joining NATO. And so the tendency, I think, has been to employ methods, which the method of, for example, the imposition of sanctions, it's understandable that these are appealing, I suppose, because it's something that should have and could eventually have a lot of impact. But the thing is that the kind of impact it has, first of all, it's uncertain. Its results are uncertain and tend to take a long time to produce an outcome. Like, for example, a lot of people point to Iran and say the reason that they've come to the table on the nuclear program is because of the effect of sanctions. But I think that over a long term it might produce that outcome. But in the shorter term, I'm afraid what it tends to do is harm other achievements, I suppose, or accomplishments of Western engagement with Russia, which has been the main theme of our diplomacy for 25 years. What I mean by that is that I do think that the Russia of today is, even though it may be tending toward a more authoritarian rule, it still isn't equivalent to the Soviet Union in the sense that there's a tremendous engagement of the public as a whole in travel and contacts with the West and so on, and the rise of a middle class, which I still say is very portentous for the eventual transformation of Russia toward a more European model. And I'm afraid that the kind of a reaction, in other words, the failure to try to seek any kind of accommodation on the Ukrainian crisis could actually push Russia further away from the sort of integration that might be very desirable from the standpoint of international security. So I have a lot of concerns about that, knowing as I do that a great many Russians were very favorably disposed toward Europe and toward the United States and probably still are. So I just think it's very important to remember that Putin isn't Russia and Russia isn't Putin, and that its policies founded upon that idea that it is are bad or are unlikely to bring desirable results from the standpoint of American interest and international security.
Where do we go from here? Molly's gotten us started on this. John Mearsheimer, how do we get out of this crisis?
What the West should do is it should take NATO expansion off the table. And it should make clear to the Russians that what we want to do is create a neutral Ukraine. We want to create a Ukraine that's basically a neutral buffer state between Russia on one side and the West or NATO on the other side. We want to make it clear that we won't accept the government or we won't deal with a government in Kiev that is in any way deeply anti-Russian and pro-Western. And what we want to do is also work with the Russians, and the Russians were willing to do this in 2013 before the crisis, foster some sort of economic deal that allows the EU, the IMF, the United States, and the Russians to work to help the Ukrainians get their economy back on the tracks, and we can, you know, hopefully develop a prosperous Ukraine. But that's the only solution to this situation. Now, a lot of people will say, but John, don't the Ukrainians have a right to decide whether or not they want to become part of the West? And my answer is they don't have that right, and it's foolish to encourage them to think that they have that right. Did Cuba have a right to invite the Soviet Union to put military forces in Cuba during the Cold War? No. Does Taiwan have a right to declare its formal independence? No, because if it does, China will move in and crush it. The fact is that if you're a relatively small country like Ukraine and you live next door to a guerrilla, you have to pay very careful attention to how that guerrilla thinks, because otherwise you'll get crushed. The guerrilla will do terrible things to you. So from Ukraine's point of view, from the point of view of the Ukrainian people, the best possible situation here is to give up this dream of becoming part of the West and instead become a buffer state like Austria and Finland during the Cold War and do everything possible not to get caught between Russia on one side and the West on the other side. So I think that's the best solution. But do I think it's likely that we will move in that direction? No. And I think the principal reason is because the West is now so deeply committed to the narrative or to the story that Putin is a bad guy and can't be dealt with in a diplomatic way. I mean, I think Molly's exactly right about how we've lost our interest in dealing diplomatically with Moscow and trying to solve this crisis. All we do is talk about more sanctions and more this and more that and getting tougher and tougher with the Russians. This is not the way to go. The way to go is to try and work out a deal with the Russians where we create a neutral Ukraine.
Anthony, Antoine, do you agree?
I agree partially. I think that it's an interesting solution to have a buffer state. I think it's very valuable to have a state that has links both with its Western neighbors and its Eastern neighbors. But I do also see the same problem, that I think that given this day and age, it's not very likely to happen. I would also urge NATO to just get out of there and not say anything about the problems at the moment, just not to put more oil on the fire. And there might be a chance, but for that also we'll see what the new EU leadership does, there might be a chance to use the EU as a more neutral element in there. EU has for long been especially about economic issues and not necessarily and not so much about military issues, which was more the realm of NATO. The EU could, if it has its new leadership in place, could you perform a kind of mediator role that would try to lower tensions and definitely see to it that no more oil on the fire is spilled. I do think that John is right in saying that if we can convince the Russians that there is no threat of annexing, if you were, Ukraine to the West, that there might be a solution and that can come. The only thing is that I think for Ukraine to be able to survive this neutrality, it will need money. It's today broke. It's heavily dependent on one side. And if you want this state to survive, then I think there's going to be an effort necessary from both the West and the East to get the country effectively running, because today it's not possible.
I'm Rob English.
Whatever we do, we better do it fast. The prescriptions of John Mearsheimer and Anthony Antoine are sensible. I'm concerned that we need to act fast because we've been, and the West has been, and the Ukrainian government has been pursuing these policies on credit or with promises for the future. And when the cost of reforms, the new cost of energy, the really painful austerity measures that the IMF is insisting that the Ukrainian government launch, even as it's in complete chaos, when all that hits, I would not be surprised to see Ukrainians, and I mean Western Ukrainians, protesting as strongly against their current government, their shiny new elected government, as they did against the old pro-Russian Yanukovych government. We have very little idea of how much instability, how much poverty and suffering, and how much chaos will ensue, not because of guns, but because of a lack of butter.
Robert English, thank you so much.
You.
Anthony Antoine, John Mearsheimer,
You're
Molly
welcome.
O'Neill, great to have all four of you on here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Robert English is a professor of international relations and the director of the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Russia and the Idea of the West, The Politics of Russian National Identity, and The Other Side, How Soviets and Americans Perceive Each Other. John Mearsheimer is professor of political science and the co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago. He's the author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy and Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. Molly O'Neill is a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University and a former diplomat in the region. Her forthcoming book is called Democracy, Civic Culture, and Small Business in Russia's Regions. Anthony Antoine is the executive director of the Institute for European Studies at the University of Brussels. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and Khwatema Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.